Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast to check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. While you're over there, make sure you check out all the other things that 1517 is doing. The articles, the events, the podcasts, the academies, the preaching helps, all the stuff that we're doing. You can check all of it out over there. There are some events over there that you could register for. I'm just saying you should go to the events page and search around. Chad, last week, Jezebel got thrown out a window by some eunuchs, and the dogs were hungry in that day, apparently, and there was not much left of her, and that's sort of where we ended. I mean, Jehu is on a rampage. He's if you ever wondered what the wrath of God would look like fully flushed out. Like, it seems like you have the cross, which is where the wrath of God ultimately resides. And then you have, if you want to know what you've been spared, you can look at Jehu and be like, this is what you had coming if it wasn't for Jesus.
Yeah, he's been on quite the rampage. And as we'll see, jumping here into chapter 10, he's not done. he's got a lot more rampaging to do before he's finished. But yeah, pretty grotesque, bloody ending to chapter 9, where Jezebel gets thrown out the window and then mostly devoured by the dogs on the street. So we're going to transition from that bloody scene to another bloody scene. And this one's going to deal with the 70 sons of Ahab in Samaria, which is how the chapter starts out, 2 Kings chapter 10. Ahab had 70 sons in Samaria. These are most likely sons and grandsons. So the Hebrew word ben, which is ordinarily translated as son, it's the same as bat in Hebrew, which is a word for daughter. It can encompass both son and grandson, just like bat can encompass both daughter and granddaughter. So maybe, you know, kings did have multiple wives and concubines and whatnot. So these might actually be 70 sons, but I'm guessing this is probably sons and grandsons.
It seems like if you're wondering how to read this, I always read something like this as, you know, descendants. This is your family, whatever his family tree looked like coming down from him, that's what we're talking about.
Yeah, it's basically going to be anybody who might be put into a position where they can basically reign in place of Ahab. That's what's being set up here. By the way, if that's 70 sons rings a bell, like if you're an Old Testament person, which obviously you are because you're listening to our podcast, or if you've been a long-time listener, you'd be like, yeah, did somebody else have 70 sons? Yes, they did, actually, back in the wonderful holy days of the Judges. There was the guy named Gideon, who in Judges chapter 8, verse 30, we are told had 70 sons. And interestingly, another tie-in between Judges 8 and this, those 70 sons, with the one exception, one guy got away, were executed. That was back when Abimelech had all these sons of Gideon, after Gideon died, had all these sons executed so that he could be the king. So, you know, not exact parallel, but somewhat of a parallel here between 70 sons being murdered back then and now 70 sons, as we'll see in a moment, are going to be beheaded in this case. So Ahab has these 70 sons in Samaria, and now Yahu is going to do something kind of interesting here. He's going to twice in two different ways. He's going to test the loyalty. Well, first of all, he's going to find out if they're on his side, the people that he's about to write a letter to. And he does this in a very sneaky sort of way. So he gets some pen and paper, and he sits down, and he's going to write a letter to the rulers of Samaria and the elders and the guardians of the sons of Ahab. So these are basically the people in political control of the city. They're the ones who have been making sure that the sons and grandsons, these descendants of Ahab, are trained in all the various ways, or the guardians, the teachers, whatnot. So to them, Yahu writes these letters. And here's what he says. Now then, as soon as this letter comes to you, seeing your master's sons are with you, and there are with you chariots and horses, fortified cities also, and weapons. So, you know, since you've got Ahab's sons, and since you have all this stuff, select the best and fittest of your master's sons and set him on his father's throne and fight for your master's house. Now, if you just read that, not knowing Yahu, not knowing what he's done and certainly not knowing what he will do, you might be thinking to yourself, well, this is kind of a strange. Why would this guy who just staged a coup and took out the king and has been exalted as king himself would be writing letters to these rulers of Samaria telling them to put another guy on the throne? Well, of course, that's the whole test, right? He's going to see how they react to this. Will they respond by actually doing that? Or will they respond by saying, no way. No, there's no way that we would do that because we're on your side, Yahoo. So they get the letter, and verse 4 tells us the reaction. And we know right away the direction they're going to go. It says, but they were exceedingly afraid and said, behold, the two kings could not stand before him. They're talking about Yahoo. The two kings, the king from the north and the king from the south, both of whom were assassinated by Yahoo. Those two guys couldn't stand before him. How then can we stand? So they realize right away the tone of this letter was such that he wasn't serious. He didn't actually want them to do this. He was testing them to see kind of where they stood on him and his newly inaugurated, very bloody reign. So what happens? Verse 5 tells us that he who was over the palace and he who was over the city, together with the elders and the guardians, so everybody kind of gets together, all these people that were addressed by the initial letter, they get together, and they sent a message back to Yahoo, and here's what they said. We are your servants, and we will do all that you tell us. We will not make anyone king, so do whatever is good in your eyes. All right, so you're catching the way this is going. So he sends a letter to test them out, see where they're at. They write a letter back because, of course, they don't want to die. They're afraid, and so they say, listen, yeah, we are definitely with you. Whatever you want us to do, just say it, and we'll get it done. Whatever is good in your eyes is going to be good with us as well.
But this is a smart way to do this, that you're trying to figure out. You get a letter, you're fairly certain that you're like, this is a test, this is a trap, this is not, we don't want to do this. However, I also don't want to appear like we're disobedient, like we're not willing to do stuff. And so the response is good, which is, hey man, whatever you want to do, it's fine with us. Here's the issue. We're not kingmakers. Like, you want to make someone king? That's great. And I will be totally down for that. That'll be the king. We'll support it. So that's fine. So anything you want, we'll do. But we don't make kings. You make the king, then, you know, we'll serve him or whatever. It's a good move.
Yeah. It's basically, you know, throwing the ball back toward him.
Yeah.
You make the decision as to what you want to happen. So, verse 6 tells us that he wrote them a second letter. So this letter is much more direct. The first one was just kind of, okay, let's see what these guys say. Okay, well, they've responded. They've said, we're with you, and you tell us what to do. So he's tested them once. Now he's going to test them again. He's going to make sure that they put their money where their mouth is. Make sure that not only are they just saying we're going to be faithful to you, he's going to test that fidelity and see if they actually do what he tells them. Now, this is pretty fascinating too, because this can be this letter, and we've all received like text or emails or actual letters where we have to do a little bit of interpretation. Be like, you know, what was the tone when this was written? You know, what exactly does this mean? We've all kind of done a little bit of exegesis with regard to correspondence that we have received. They have to do the same thing, except this one is a pretty serious interpretation that they have to make. Because in the second letter, Yahoo says this: if you are on my side, and if you are ready to obey me, and by the way, we've mentioned this multiple times, but this is a great chance to say it. In Hebrew, it's listen to the voice of, it's not obey. Uh-huh. It's the Hebrew idiom here. So they're listening to his voice, just like we listen to the voice of God, and his word has its way with us. So this is Yahoo saying, if you're listening to my voice, if you're going to let my word have its way with you, then here's what I want you to do. Now, this is the part where we have to interpret. Take the heads of your master's sons and come to me at Jezreel tomorrow at this time. Now, here's where the head part is where you have to do some interpretation, because as in Hebrew, so also in English. You know, I can talk about the head of state, right? I can talk about the head of a company. I can talk about the head of any organization or any group whatsoever. And when I'm talking about the head of an organization or group, of course, I'm talking about the leadership, right? Now, that's one way you can interpret head. But the other way is you can interpret it quite literally, right? We all have an actual head on our body. So what does Yahu mean? Does he mean to, I want you to assemble the leaders of all of your master's sons and bring them to me at Jezreel tomorrow? Does he mean like actual get these guys together and bring them?
Like we're gonna have a meeting. I need you to bring the.
We're gonna have a meeting. Yeah, we're gonna have a little powwow. We're gonna sit down and we're gonna talk through things.
Get the five eldest sons of Ahab and meet me over here. We're gonna have a little conversation with them.
Yeah. There's 70 of them. So obviously there's gonna be a few that stand out. They're the heads. They're the leaders of this group. So. Send them as a representative group. We'll talk.
I feel like this is
One way you can interpret that.
I feel like this is harder than so. You get this text message, right? You're hanging out with the guys, and then your wife texts you and says, "What time will you be home?" Now,
yes.
Now,
how do you interpret that?
Is she just wondering what time you will be home? Do you respond with a time, because this is the question, or do you say to the guys, "I gotta go"? Because what this text actually means is you need to be in the car immediately because it's getting late.
It's Saturday morning. you're loading up your golf clubs in the trunk of the car, and your wife says, "Are you going golfing today?" So is she really asking? Is she seeking information, or is she saying something else?
Like technically, you can respond to such a text message or the question, "Are you going golfing?" And you can just give the answer. I'm sure you could be, you could say, "Well, you just asked what time. I told you what time." But you're supposed to know. I feel like this is harder than that, because I know when I get that text message of "When are you coming home?" that means that I need to be coming home right then. Like, the only answer to that text that I need to give is, "I'm on my way. I was just leaving. Yes. I'll be there in 15 minutes," whatever. This is more difficult, because if you get this one wrong, you're trying to decide if you're supposed to gather some dudes or if you're supposed to kill some dudes. You can't just text them back.
No.
For clarity.
This is a little more difficult, so... they decide, probably what happens is, okay, they get this letter, they're reading it, they're having, a little conversation here, and they're thinking, "Oh, what does he mean?" And they think, "Well, let's just look at what he's done so far. Let's look at the character and the actions of this person who sent us this letter. What has he just done? Well, he just wiped out a whole bunch of people. There's blood everywhere that, the Yahu goes. So I'm thinking he probably means for us to take this quite literally." Whatever the conversation they had, that's the interpretation they came up with.
This seems like you deciding, maybe your wife's phone dies and you decided, "Does my wife want to know what time I'm coming home, or does she want me to come home right now? Let me look down through the past experiences I have with her. I think she wants me to come home right now."
That would be good exegesis.
Yeah.
Good marital exegesis there. Yeah.
She's not actually looking for a time.
So she's not looking for a time. And Yahu was probably actually looking for literal heads. That's what happens anyway. After they read the letter, it says the king's son, 70 persons, we're with the great men of the city. We're bringing them up. We already knew that. Just kind of bringing us up to speed on that once more. So verse 7 says that as soon as the letter came to them, they took the king's sons and slaughtered them. That is a good translation. Hebrew has a lot of different words, not a lot, but a few different words that can indicate the taking the life of someone. Kind of a general term for killing. There's a very specific word for bloodshed. And there's also a very specific word, shahat, which is best translated as slaughter. And that's what's used here. So they shahat them.
This is like a sacrifice term almost, right?
Yeah.
Like
yeah,
slaughtering bulls, so they goats. Slaughtered them.
That's it. Yeah, 70 persons. And one of the reasons that this verb is used is the way in which these men were killed. So they were all beheaded. Maybe something else was done to them in addition to that, but we're told that after they were shahat, slaughtered, they put their heads in baskets and sent them to him at Jezreel. Now, that's another kind of interesting detail. When he wrote the letter, he said, I want you to take the heads of your master's sons and come to me at Jezreel tomorrow. These guys are going to play it safe. They're going to chop the heads off these sons, and then they're going to send them to him at Jezreel. So they want to keep a little distance. They're going to, you know, do what he said, at least the way they interpreted what he said, but they're going to keep a little distance between themselves and this evidence of their obedience. So verse 8 says, when the messenger came and told him, that is Jehu, they have brought the heads of the king's sons. Then Jehu says, well, here's what I want you to do with them. Let's lay them in two heaps at the entrance of the gate until the morning. So I suppose if you want to send a message, that's certainly one way to do that.
Yeah.
We're gonna put 35 heads on this side, 35 heads on that side. It's pretty unmissable indication of what's going to happen to you if you decide to go against Jehu.
Yeah, that's pretty good deterrent from doing anything that you might not should do. I'm also wondering how many guys does Jehu have that are, you know, loyal to him? It takes some doing. Like, so you got 70 sons. Well, how many guys in there at this place are, you know, willing to do the will of Jehu or whatever? We'll do whatever you want. Like, how many? What's he got? Like a 500 guys in there or what? Because it's seems like 70 guys to you have to, you know, that's a big fight on your hands.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a lot of people to subdue and to force into the posture of execution.
Yeah.
So, anyway, that's what happened. They made these stacks, two heaps on either side of the gate until morning. And then in the morning, Jehu gets up, he goes out, and he's going to make a little speech. He says to all the people. Now, this first the first part of his speech is, I'm guessing, is sarcastic. The ESV has, you are innocent. Robert Alter, in his translation, adds a word just to kind of set the tone of this. So he adds, well, something like, well, you are innocent. It's kind of that tone of, well, aren't you innocent? In other words, no, you're not innocent, because look, here's these two heaps of all these heads of people that you have just killed. So you're not innocent. Even you are innocent, but the tone seems to be indicating you're not innocent, because look what you've done. He goes on, it was I who conspired against my master and killed him, but who struck down all of these? So in other words, he's saying, there's blood on my hands. I admit that. I struck down the king. I was anointed to do so. I took him out. But look, we're in this together now, right? You're obviously an accomplice to this, because you just killed the 70 sons of Ahab. All I said was bring me their heads, right? I didn't say I want you to slaughter the sons of Ahab, cut off their heads, and bring them to me. That's the way that you interpreted my words, but I didn't say that explicitly. But you did this. You struck down all these guys. So now, look, we're all in this together. He's a very, very sneaky, coy kind of politician. I mean, he's a fierce warrior too, but he's also got some political bones in him.
Yeah, this is how you bring some people into some mutually assured destruction, right? So like, well, you're on my side now, because if this goes badly, like, we're all in trouble. You're not going to be able to put it on me, because I'm going to be able to say, oh, no, I was just wanting to have a conversation. And next thing I know, 70 heads in baskets show up. So that wasn't me. That was you.
Yeah, he's shedding a lot of blood. So he's obviously capable of that, but he's also capable of some pretty smart maneuvering politically, which is what he just did here. He goes on. Now, so he's done the warrior thing, he's done the politician thing, and now he's going to be a kind of a preacher, prophet. He's going to say in verse 10, know then that there shall fall to the earth nothing of the word of the Lord. So that's an idiom that we've encountered before back in, I believe it was, 1 Samuel 3:19. Uses that same kind of expression. So when it says that not a word will fall to the ground, it means that it's all going to be accomplished. So nothing's going to be lost, in other words. You're not going to have some word from God, as it were, slip through the cracks unfulfilled. So nothing of all that God has spoken is going to fall to the earth. It's all going to be accomplished. And then he goes on to talk about this promise that the Lord made concerning Ahab. He says, for which the Lord spoke concerning the house of Ahab, for the Lord has done what he said by his servant Elijah. So back in 1 Kings, I believe it was chapter 19, when God told Elijah to do what Elijah actually never did, and that is to anoint Hazael king of Syria and then to anoint Jehu as king over the northern kingdom, Elijah never did that. It was up to Elisha to take care of that. But the prophecy was made back then, and it's been waiting fulfillment all these times until finally now Jehu has actually brought it to pass. God said he would destroy the house of Omri / Ahab, and that is precisely what has now just happened. So verse 11 finishes up this paragraph. It says, so Jehu struck down all who remained of the house of Ahab in Jezreel, all his great men, his close friends, his priest, until he left none remaining. So kind of mop-up operation, you know, besides these 70 sons that were in Samaria, 70 sons, grandsons, Samaria, there were other people in Jezreel who were, maybe they were, you know, advisors, whoever they were all super close to Ahab. He takes out them as well. He's, you know, he's checking every place to make sure there's no vestige left of anyone who's related to Ahab or was close to him during his lifetime. All right, he's not done. Verse 12 starts another paragraph. He sets out and goes to Samaria. And on the way, when he was at a place called Beth Eked, so the house of Eked, of the shepherds, he meets the relatives of Ahaziah, king of Judah. Now, you remember earlier that when Jehu had his first encounter with the king of the north and king of the south, he ended up killing both of them, right? And the king of the south was Ahaziah. So these are the relatives of the king of Judah, the king of the southern kingdom, that Jehu has already killed, except these people don't know that. They have no idea everything that's happened. You know, they didn't get the press release. So they're on their way. And Jehu says to them, who are you? And they say, well, we're Ahaziah's family. We're his relatives. You know, the king of the south. We're his family. And
obviously these guys have not heard about what happened a little way down the road.
Totally in the dark here.
Or they are complete fools. I mean, this is not the guy that you say, oh, me? Oh, I'm the relative of the person that you killed. Don't do that. Your answer, who are you? You say, I'm nobody. Absolutely nobody.
No, but we were just out for a ride. Just happened to be in this area. That's all. No, but they say we're the relatives of Ahaziah, and we came down to visit the royal princes and the sons of the queen mother. So not only are they say we're the relatives of the guy you just killed, but we were going to visit the very people that were just beheaded at your, you know, implicit request. Yehu responds, take them alive. Well, they take them alive, but they didn't stay alive very long. They must have been transported elsewhere. They're taken alive, but then immediately thereafter, we read, they took them alive. And no surprise here, they also shahat them, slaughtered them at the pit of Beth Eked. There were 42 of these, and he spared none of them. No surprise there either. So everywhere that he's going, he's taking out folk. I have not been doing the math here, but you know, we've got two kings, we've got the 70, now we have 42. It's adding up pretty. The death toll here is out of control, and he's not done yet. But before we get into the next killing, we have a little kind of partnership, you might say, that develops. That's what the next little section's about. And this is actually kind of fascinating, and it ties in, interestingly, with something in Jeremiah. So here's what happened. He goes from there, and along the way, he meets a fella by the name of Jehonadab, who is the son of Rechab, and he's coming to meet him. All right? And I'll explain who he is in just a minute. He greets him, Yahu greets him, and he says to him, "Is your heart true to mine is to yours?" It's evident that these guys, they know each other. So, in other words, are you with me on this? And Jehonadab, this guy he just met, says, "Yep, I sure am." So Yahu says, "Well, if that's the case, well, then give me your hand. Let's shake hands." So he gives him his hand, they shake hands, and then Yahu takes him up into the chariot with him and says, "Come with me and see my zeal for the Lord." Well, he's got plenty of that. He's got, you know, he's uber zealous for the Lord. So brings him in the chariot, says, "Come along with me. I'm going to show you how zealous I am for Yahweh." So we had him riding his chariot. And they go, verse 17, they go all the way to Samaria. And when they get there, they struck down everybody who was left, everybody who remained to Ahab in Samaria, till he had wiped them out, according to the word of the Lord that he spoke to Elijah. So who is this guy? So Jehonadab, this is by the way, is around 830, 840 BC, just kind of orient yourself time-wise. So Yahu and this guy by the name of Jehonadab, the son of Rechab, they get together, they have this conversation. So this is around 840 BC. Skip forward to around 600 BC. So, I mean, 2 centuries later. In the time of Jeremiah. Jeremiah, of course, lived right before and then during and then right after the time of the Babylonian destruction of Jerusalem and the temple in 586. So this is before, in Jeremiah's ministry, before the temple was actually destroyed. So we'll say around 600. And we learned there from Jeremiah chapter 35 that these descendants of Jehonadab are still around. And they're kind of they're a very strict ascetic sect. They're called the Rechabites. So you remember that we read that Jehonadab is the son of Rechab. And so the Rechabites are the descendants of Rechab and his son Jehonadab. And you might have stumbled across this if you've read Jeremiah before. These people had adopted kind of this very strict ascetic lifestyle. And there are certain things that they wouldn't do. So when Jeremiah has this conversation with them, he's saying, "Hey, I know that you are very faithful. You're very obedient to kind of your family, your clan's history, and this lifestyle handed down to you." And they say, "Yes, we are." In fact, Rechab, who's kind of the forefather of our group, forbade us from drinking wine. He says, "We're not to build a house or sow seed or plant or own a vineyard. Instead, we're to live in tents." So they developed this kind of nomadic lifestyle, when they refrain from drinking wine. They don't do the things that farmers usually do. So it's a very odd kind of group within the Jews, within the Israelites at the time of Jeremiah. Now, Jeremiah is using them basically to make the point that, listen, these Rechabites are faithful. They're obedient to their forefather. He told them, don't do these things and do this, and that's what they do. But you're not obedient to what God says you are to do. That's the way that's used in Jeremiah chapter 35. But what I find interesting is that here, in the case of Yahu, we meet basically the founder of that group, or at least his son, Jehonadab. So there's a connection here between what's happening with 2 Kings and then all the way in Jeremiah a couple centuries later. Okay.
This was the impetus for that. Maybe this dude was like, "Let me show you my zeal for the Lord." And he's like, "Okay." They go out, slaughters all these guys, and then this dude was like, "Tell you what I'm going to do going forward. I'm going to put together my people, and we're never going to be in positions of power. We're just going to live in tents. We're never going to give anyone any reason to get all zealous for the Lord on us."
That makes perfect sense to me. having seen what he just did, and he's actually going to be there, too, at what happens next. So having seen all that, yeah, maybe Jehonadab was like, "You know what? I'm going to make sure that my sons and grandsons and great grandsons, all these generations to come, I'm going to make sure that they are never in a position where they end up on the wrong end of the sword facing somebody like Yahu."
Yes.
Yeah, makes sense.
Never
drink wine. So you're never going to get drunk.
Nope.
And maybe do something you shouldn't do. I don't want you to live in towns. You live in tents, yep. right? And I want you to have like mobility. I don't want you to be stuck to a vineyard or to a field. You want to be able to move around. And,
we just want people to be able to say, "Hey, what's up with those people?" And the response to be, "Oh, don't worry about them. They live in tents and they're not bothering anybody. Don't worry about them." It's the best way to be.
Yeah, it'd be kind of like, you know, no one's going to accuse the Amish of like being political enemies of the state, right?
Right. Right.
Yeah, it's kind of like that, you know. Oh, well, yeah, the Rechabites, they're the Amish, you know. You don't have to worry about them. They just have their own kind of thing that they do. It's kind of out of step with everybody else. So anyway, what's going to happen next? Well, you know, he gets in the chariot and he's about to have a great sacrifice to Baal. That's what's going to come up here. But this is not going to be the sacrifice that the worshipers of Baal anticipated. So Yehu gathers all the people together. He assembles them. And here's what he says. He's like, "Ahab served Baal a little, but Yehu will serve him much." He's going to be this great Baal worshiper. We'll see how this happens. So he says, here's what I want you to do. Call to me all the prophets of Baal. I mean, every single one, all his worshipers, all his priests. Let none be missing because I have a great sacrifice to offer to Baal. In fact, if you're not there, you're going to die. Whoever is missing shall not live. So we're going to make sure we have all the priests, all the prophets, all the worshipers, everybody who's officially connected with Baal. I want to have this great sacrifice. And it's so important that if you're not there, I'm going to hunt you down and kill you.
Dude, this guy is out of control with his
his rhetoric.
You guys are weak Baal worshipers. I mean, the king before me, like his Baal worship was little. Like my Baal worship is going to be something to behold, and I want you to behold it. In fact, if you don't behold it, I'm going to kill you. I know I'm letting the cat out of the bag here, but it is a wondrous thing to say, you have to come to my thing where I'm going to kill all of you, and if you don't, I'm going to kill you. So you use the threat of death as a way to gather up all the people who you are certainly going to put to death. And in the whole, I'm going to make a great sacrifice to Baal. Yeah, come on, man. Like, this dude is...
Yeah, this whole thing is so over the top. It's a complete Yahoo kind of moment. I mean, this guy, we've met a few of these people who are like, everything is 100%. Doesn't matter what it is, it's 100%. Well, this guy is 110%. Then we're told, as if we needed to be told this, but sometimes the Bible does tell us things that are pretty obvious. Yahoo did it with cunning in order to destroy the worshipers of Baal. Yeah, I would say this is done with cunning deceitfulness. This is the Hebrew root of this is the same root for Jacob, you know, that deceitful kind of guy. So this is that cunning guy. So Jacob did this with the character of Jacob with cunning in order to destroy the worshipers of Baal. So he ordered that they were to sanctify a solemn assembly for Baal. So that's the proclamation that they made, and this message goes out throughout all Israel. All the worshipers of Baal came, so that, we read, there was not a man left who didn't come. And they go into the house of Baal. The house of Baal is like, you know, packed. It's filled from one end to the other. You got all these people there. And not satisfied with having everybody there, Yehu also said, you know what, find whoever is in charge of the vestry, where they keep the sacred garments. Whoever's in charge of the wardrobe, I want you to find that guy and have him bring out vestments for all the worshipers of Baal. So whatever these vestments were, we don't know. That would be an interesting detail to find out. But they got these sacred garments that are worn by the worshipers of Baal, and they have, you know, the wardrobe is full. So they're bringing out all these vestments, and everybody's making sure that they're clothed. And of course, the reason for this is to make sure that everybody knows who's who, right? You got your team's uniform on here. So this is the Baal team. They have that particular vestment on. So he brings vestments out, and then Yehu goes into the house of Baal. So he's into this temple with Jehonadab, the son of Rechab, the one that we just talked about. And he said to the worshipers of Baal, they should have been suspicious, you know, You would think by now they would be suspicious, but whatever. He says to them, to the Baal people, search and see that there is no servant of the Lord here among you, but only the worshipers of Baal. I want to make sure that everybody here, nobody wants to have anything to do with Yahweh. These are all just Baal people. So they go in, they offer sacrifices, burn offerings. So all this is going on inside. Outside, Yahu gathers his soldiers together. He's got 80 men. And he gathers these guys together. You know, they're away from the worshipers of Baal, so they can't overhear what's happening. And he says to these 80 guys, the man who allows any of those, talking about the people inside, the man who allows any of those whom I give into your hands to escape shall forfeit his life. You have a feeling like Yahu is like just issuing death threats left and right here. Like, if you don't come to this worship service, you're going to die. If you let one of these worshipers escape, you're going
to
die.
Yeah, he really thinks that killing you is a good way to get you to do what he wants you to do. Like so the threat of him, the threat of losing your life and Yahu's mind, this is the best way to get someone to do something.
Yeah, that's like his number one motivation for getting anything accomplished that he wants to get accomplished. If you don't do this, you're going to die.
And nobody has any reason not to believe him, too. They're like, oh, I think he's serious.
Yeah, Yahu says that. Yeah, he's totally serious. He's not joking. He's not bluffing. So, verse 25, as soon as he had made, now the he part, was this Yahu? Was this somebody else? We're not told. Just he. As soon as he had made an end of offering the burnt offering, Yahu said to the guard and to the officers, go in and strike them down. Let not a man escape. Of course, we saw this coming. That's what happened. They go in, they put them all to death with the sword. The guard and the officers then take the bodies of these men, however many there were, cast them out, and went into the inner room of the house of Baal. Maybe this is kind of like the equivalent of the Holy of Holies in the temple in Jerusalem. So this inner room of the house of Baal. And inside there was a pillar. Know what this was like. It's Matzevah, which is the sometimes translated sacred pillars. These are what were forbidden for the Israelites to have. So maybe a depiction of Baal or something like that. Anyway, they brought out the pillar that was in the house of Baal and they burned it. And they then demolished this pillar of Baal, demolished the house of Baal. So they do all this. They kill all these people. They destroy the pillar. They destroy the temple. So you got destruction, you got bloodshed, you got this demolition of this pagan house. Now, if you wanted to, if you're Yahu and you've done all this, and you really want, I mean, you have accomplished a great deal destructive-wise and death-wise, but if you want to really, really put the exclamation on this, I mean, you just want to make sure that to add the ultimate insult to this injury, then what are you going to do? Well, here's an idea. Why don't you take this temple that you have destroyed, filled with the blood of the worshipers, you burned a pillar, you've done all this stuff, and why don't you transform it now into a public restroom?
Yes. It says that he made it into a latrine to this day.
To this day.
You know, if you're worried about people going back to the sacred space and like, you know, re-establishing some Baal worship. You don't want, like, secret nighttime Baal worship going on. Yeah, you just make it a bathroom.
Yeah, yeah. And so here's a interesting little archaeological detail. And for those of you out there who have read Unveiling Mercy, my devotional, I talk about this on August 28th. So in 2016, at Tel Lachish in Israel, Archaeologists discovered that there had been some sort of sacred temple or something like that, and inside they found a toilet. Now, this is a different place, okay? This is a different place than what we're talking about here. This is Samaria. This is Tel Lachish. However, same thing. So this place that was, you know, formerly used for Baal worship or whatever kind of worship was going on now is transformed into a place for using the restroom. So that, you know, probably was, in other words, not the only time that something like this happened. This was, you know, this is how you really completely insult and desecrate this place that was once considered holy by worshipers of pagan gods. Well, you just make sure it's a place where people go to use the restroom.
That's this guy is a different kind of guy.
He's a different breed. Yeah, there is no one among the kings, north or south, that's quite like Yahu. He is definitely one of a kind.
Yeah, and you would
he has zeal for the Lord, right? Like you said, I come and see my zeal for the Lord.
Yeah, and what's wild, and we'll get into this next week, is you would think this guy has got to be as devoted to Yahweh as anybody ever has been. I mean, look at this guy, and we'll find out what his sort of his reign is like, and turns out he's not perfect either.
Yeah, that'll be how we kind of wrap up his story. You would think everything we've said. I mean, this is the pinnacle of zeal for Yahweh, but there is a but there. We'll find out exactly how far that zeal extended.
That's right.
Next week.
All right, Chad. Well, I will see you then.
All right, see you then.